From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Everyone knows who Ronald Reagan was, but just who was George Gipp? Ahead on Only a Game, we'll answer that question, and we'll consider how much Reggie Bush regrets having to return his 2005 Heisman Trophy. Hint, not very much. Also, a Chicago high school basketball team gets a chance at revenge 10 years after an underdog and a controversial call killed their playoff aspirations. Also, after four decades as the White Sox ballpark organist, Nancy Faust prepares for retirement by letting everyone in on a little secret.
And I think I really wasn't going to work. I had them fooled. I wasn't going to work. I was leaving the house and going straight to a grand party.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The National League wildcard race is just that, wild. Atlanta, San Diego, and Colorado are fighting for a postseason spot alongside possible division winners Philadelphia, Cincinnati, and San Francisco. In the American League, the Yankees will win the East if Tampa Bay doesn't, and if Tampa Bay does, the Yankees will be the wild card, and they will still be the Yankees. Texas and the surprising Minnesota Twins are likely to round out the mix. Joining me now on the line is Lavelle E. Neal III, who covers the Twins for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Lavelle, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
The Twins swept Chicago in this week's potentially crucial series with the White Sox. They're now in the hunt for the best record in the American League. Is team morale at a season high?
I would say yes. You know, the amazing thing here, Bill, is that since the All-Star break, the Twins are playing baseball at a 720 clip, which is pretty ridiculous. But a lot of things have fallen into place for them. The schedule the rest of the way is very favorable. They really don't play a team that has a record over 500. I think Toronto's hovering around 500 and Oakland's hovering around 500. But other than that, they're facing Cleveland and Kansas City. So they have a chance to continue this run here. And with Tampa Bay and the Yankees still having to play several games against each other, and theoretically they will beat each other up, the Twins do have a great shot here of exiting with the best record in American League, which would probably also be the best record in Major League Baseball.
When you think about the 2010 Twins roster, Joe Mauer, Justin Morneau, and Jim Thome leap to mind, but tell me a little bit about the cast of characters that has been responsible for Minnesota's successful season.
Well, you know, it's been kind of a remarkable season because the Twins have had to improvise on the fly here. Their closer, Joe Nathan, who's one of the best in the game, was lost for the year in spring training with an elbow injury. They traded for Matt Capps from the Washington Nationals, and he was their closer. They also have Brian Fuentes from the Angels. He was their closer at the beginning of the year. Bill, the Twins have three relievers in that bullpen right now who all have at least 20 saves this year, and you don't see that too often. And from there, they've had some other injuries. You know, Justin Morneau is still out. He's been out since July 7th because of a concussion suffered when he got kneed in the head while sliding into second base. And Michael Kadire has played first base, but he's also played left, center, right, second, and third this year. And a rookie third baseman was called up by the name of Danny Valencia. And he's fielded well, and he's hit around 300, and he's driven in a few runs. And it looks like he's finally their third baseman of the future. The big thing is that the pitch has been fairly consistent. Carl Bovano, has won 17 games. Francisco Liriano, a lot of people remember Francisco Liriano. In 2006, he had a remarkable year, went to the All-Star game, but then he tore a ligament in his elbow and missed all the 07 season. It's been a long road back, but Frankie has now won 14 games.
The Twins and their fans, of course, are enjoying their first year at Target Field, brand new stadium. You're there for every home game. Tell me a little bit about how Target Field is working out.
I like my new office. The thing that jumps out to me about Target Field is that it kind of has a contemporary Scandinavian feel to it, you know, with the Kasoto stone on the outside and the spaceship-looking canopy roof on top. But inside, they really did a great job of blending the past and the present. They have, you know, Gates' name for numbers of former Twins players like Kirby Puckett, Rock Carew, Ken Herbeck, and Harmon Killebrew. You walk through the ballpark, they have, you know, pictures of old Twins and new Twins. And they even have a place called the Tomball Tavern, which is down the in the left field corner. And they actually salute all the town, you know, slash Legion ball teams that play in the summer in Minnesota. And they had pictures of all these ballparks, and half of them were carved out of farmland, you know, and like the champions of the past years have their team photos in the floor. So like the St. Cloud Ice, the Class D League champions of 2009, have their team photo at Target Field.
You talk about the Scandinavian feel. They got Lutefisk at the concession stands?
I am proud to tell you that I have not found any Lutefisk at Target Field.
Well, the Yankees won it all last season, and of course that was their first year in the new Yankee Stadium, so maybe the Twins win it all this time.
You know, the funny part is that a lot of opponents, and the White Sox are at the front of that list, believe that moving out of the Metrodome that the Twins would not benefit from balls being lost in a roof or quirks or the ball careening around the ballpark. But they've come to Target Field, and they've kind of reestablished a new spot to have home field advantage now. It's a big outfield. It's a more pitcher-friendly park. But the Twins have one of the best records in baseball at home this year.
The Twins could face the Yankees, they could face the Rangers or Tampa Bay in the first round of the playoffs. Is there a matchup that Minnesota would like to see or maybe one that they would like to avoid?
I think if you talk to any team or any scout, the best way to beat the Yankees is to get them in a short series so that roster and their depth and their rotation won't ground you down. And I would say, you know, facing the Yankees in the ALDS will probably be much better than over a seven-game series, just because the longer the series goes, the more power the Yankees can display. But the Devil Rays present a lot of challenges because they are the most athletic and fastest team in baseball, and they really like to put pressure on defenses. And if you're a pitcher who you know, is not good at holding runners at first base, they're going to steal bases on you all game and really make things hairy for opponents. So, you know, the Yankees may have power in their lineup. The Rays kill you with speed, and so there's kind of different approaches there, but both have been very effective.
I'd warn Minnesotans to be a little careful about beginning to chant, "Bring on the Yankees."
Yeah, you're right about that. But I will say this, Carl Pavano, while he's a great pitcher, he's not the best pitcher in the world at keeping runners on first base. And the Devil Rays, like, attempted, I want to see seven stolen bases on them the last time they played. They will definitely have a track meet if they match up with the Twins in the first round. So I know it sounds weird, but I almost think the Twins would prefer to face the Yankees in order to avoid having to face them in the seven-game series.
Lavelle E. Neal III covers the Twins for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Lavelle, thanks very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This afternoon, the Chicago White Sox will honor their retiring ballpark organist, Nancy Faust, who has tickled the ivories at Comiskey Park and U.S. Cellular Field for just over four decades. At today's Faust Fest, the first 10,000 fans will get a Nancy Faust bobblehead doll, and all present will enjoy her deft musical touch and wordless sense of humor. Reporter Philip Graetzer produced this profile of the fleet-fingered wizardress of the Wurlitzer with the impressive repertoire.
White Sox fans, it's time to play ball!
I'm Nancy Faust, organist for the Chicago White Sox, and I'm in my 41st and final season. When I went to college, where I was a psychology major, I had friends that were avid baseball fans. And they knew that I could play all these songs just by ear. And they said, you should be playing for a ball game. So they wrote letters actually in my behalf. They wrote letters to the Cubs and the Sox. The manager at the time, who was Stu Holcomb, called and said, the job's yours. And I had really only attended one baseball game my whole life. So I came in not knowing what to do exactly. But the organ was located in center field bleachers. What I did then was mainly play songs that reflected the towns that the ballplayers were from, the states. If Bill Melton was from California, so I played California, Here We Come. But since then, I've branched out, and I do more crazy, far-out things. He just threw his bat. That is made out of Norwegian wood. Maybe it isn't, but today it will be.
My name is Josh Cantor. I've been the organist for the Boston Red Sox at Fenway Park since 2003. I went to a lot of White Sox games in the 80s when I was in high school, and it was really her style of playing that made me fall in love with the ballpark organ and dream of someday maybe being able to do that. So many of her songs are these clever and astute commentaries on something that's happening in the game or a player that's coming into the game. It's just delightful. It's just an extra level of enjoyment at the ballpark.
My name is George Kiefer. I'm the spring organist of the Chicago Cubs, Hohokam Stadium in Mesa, Arizona. I made this special trip because Nancy is one of the greatest of all time in sports music. She's technically brilliant. That's a given. But she has a great, great sense of humor that's always sustained the fans throughout the years in good times and bad times.
Oh, can you play Mrs. Robinson for Robinson Canoe, and also Inagata De Vita for Gardner?
I hope that fan was listening.
My name's Paul Gusselies. Nancy knows me. I say hi to her all the time. She knows my family, Christina and Kirsten, and my nephew, Steven. My dad, even though he's a Cub fan, we'd go up on the third base side and stand in line and say hi to Nancy. Hearing her play, it's just, it reminds me of baseball, you know. It's like old school baseball, just, and the crowd's always more into it from her compared to the piped-in music. I just definitely going to miss her.
Well, I've been here so long that kids that were 10 or 15 when I started are now, not only have they brought their children to see me, but they're bringing their grandchildren, and so it's, I'm seeing generation after generation. I'm witnessing traditions being created right here at the ballpark, right before my eyes. You see this happen, and so often you think, I'm going to get emotional, but if you could just stop time, it's just so great. I've kind of laughed to myself how my husband, Joe, and my son, Eric, have endured countless days and nights of my practicing at home so that I could come here with my best act, so that I could go to work. And I think, I really wasn't going to work. I had them fooled, but I really did. I wasn't going to work. I was leaving the house and going straight to a grand party. This is a grand party.
Nancy Faust's last day on the job will be October 3rd, the day of the White Sox regular season finale. The team has yet to announce a replacement. If you'd like to view photos of Nancy Faust and her bobblehead doll, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Of her 5-year-old son, Andrew, Janessa Pulaski said recently, he just likes making a lot of noise and he's good at it. But unlike most noisy children, Andrew Pulaski has made his mom proud with his high-volume hijinks. That's because young Pulaski won last weekend's moose calling contest at the Alaska Zoo in Anchorage. His prizes included a calendar and a moose cutout to hang on his wall. But wait, there's more! Andrew also got a $25 gift certificate good at the Moose Tooth Restaurant. One assumes that while the family was dining there, Janessa Pulaski informed Andrew that he should use his indoor voice.
I'm a moose and I love my lips. I'm a moose and I love my lips. I like my long legs and my big bony hips, but I really, really love my lips. Singing shibbity-dibbity-dibbity-doo. My lips are mighty handy.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a re-examination of George Gipp, brilliant player, classroom no-show. But first, how exactly do you return a Heisman Trophy? Do you wrap it up in bubble wrap and send it FedEx? How much insurance do you need to take out on a 25-pound straight-arming bronze figure? These are questions which must have occurred to Reggie Bush this week, or not, as he agreed to return the 2005 award to the Heisman Trophy Trust after an NCAA investigation concluded that Mr. Bush had received improper benefits while he was playing football at USC. T.J. Symers follows USC football for the L.A. Times, and he joins me now on the line. T.J., welcome to Only a Game.
How you doing, Bill?
Very well, thank you. Let's go back a bit to start. In 2005, Reggie Bush earned 784 first-place votes to Vince Young's 79 votes to win the Heisman Trophy. What else was he doing in 2005 that caused him to eventually lose that trophy?
Well, he had his parents being put up in a nice home in the San Diego area. Some people were trying to get a sports agency founded when Reggie got out of USC, and they worked out a nice deal, and his parents are being taken care of.
Despite recent developments, you still have happy memories of Bush's tenure on the USC football field. Tell me what it was like to watch Reggie Bush and the Trojans during those successful seasons.
Well, that's why I don't really care about him returning the hardware now. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, you don't wipe out memories, and the guy was brilliant. I mean, we watch sports for entertainment, you know, escape, and he provided all of that. I mean, I know I sound flippant here, but I'm very flippant about it, because you ask any group of college football fans, I'm going to give you 9 years where you can boast to everybody you know that you have the number one college football program in the land, but it'll cost you a couple years of probation a little bit later from now. Are you going to take that, or would you rather be UCLA and just stink every year?
USC had already taken Bush's name off the school record books and sent their copy of the trophy back to New York. Bush, meanwhile, is quite happily playing for the defending Super Bowl champion New Orleans Saints, making something like $8 million this season, set to make about $12 million in 2011. You think he's going to miss that trophy?
You know, come on. I mean, that's why I find this whole thing a bunch of hogwash. Do we really care whether Reggie Bush apologizes to USC? Do we really care whether he has this monstrosity sitting in his home somewhere? We've had the great moments. It's just like in baseball with the home runs that Sosa and McGuire hit. We love that time. That was a great time. I think the self-righteousness and everything else is a waste of time. You know, let's get on with it. The guy's playing for the Saints. You know, whether he's welcome back on the USC campus or not, I don't think is all that big a deal.
Well, there must be some debate going on in the L.A. Times premises, because you have a colleague there, Chris Dufresne, who wrote this week, quote, any truthful examination of Bush's misdeeds would include a heartfelt apology for throwing the university he says he loves under the bus. You don't agree?
No, I don't. I mean, and I love it. That demonstrates we still have columnists working in this business, this dying business. So God bless Chris Dufresne that he has a chance to write that. But I think he's full of it. I, you know, there's so many more important things in life than to worry about whether Reggie Bush threw USC under the bus. USC was found to be complicit in a lot of this stuff because they had a lack of institutional control. So they're cheaters. They're not going to be able to play in a bowl game for the next 2 years, and their fans catch a break because they can go now do all the vacations and plastic surgeries that they put off in the past years. Just think about how grueling it's been the last 9 years to have to make plans to go to a bowl game or watch a bowl game every year at the end of the year.
What has USC done, if anything, to fix the problems that were uncovered there?
Well, they did the biggest problem. That was to get rid of the athletic director, Mike Garrett. The job just got too big for him. And as a result, he lost control. There's an incredible amount of arrogance attached to USC, which was led by Mike Garrett, who was also a Heisman Trophy winner. Keep in mind, O.J. Simpson was also a Heisman Trophy winner. And as I remarked in the paper the other day, I'm surprised they don't like a birdcage. Don't have covers over O.J.'s and Matt Leinart, who's a stiff, sitting in Heritage Hall. We're all worked up about Reggie Bush, but there's a guy sitting in jail in the Las Vegas area, and he's got a Heisman Trophy sitting in the Heritage Hall. So USC got a good of the athletic director, has a new president. They got more compliance officers than they do football players, and they're all going to act like everything is going to be really nice for the next couple years, probably will, and then like anything in college football, there'll be the pressure to win again.
How will the team do this year?
They'll have a decent season, you know, where they have a new coach, and he's a youngster on the job, and he's already made his name kind of a laughing joke across the country, so he's going to have to redeem himself in Lane Kiffin. You know, they'll probably won't be as invincible as they were over the last 9 years. I think they can give 75 scholarships now. They lose the bowl thing at the end of the year. That's a huge deal. But they're 2-0 this year. They'll probably be 4-0 after the next 2 weeks. And, you know, it's hard to feel sorry for an institution that for a period of time placed football success over anything else.
T.J. Symers covers USC football for the L.A. Times. T.J., thanks very much.
You bet. Have a good day, Bill.
George Gipp, whose college football career and life ended in 1920, may have been the best player Notre Dame ever had. He might also have been characterized as the worst student Notre Dame ever had, except that for at least a couple of his years on the football field, he was no student at all. Jack Cavanaugh is the author of The Gipper, George Gipp, Newt Rockne, and the Dramatic Rise of Notre Dame Football. He joins me now from WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Jack, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for inviting me, Bill.
When George Gipp arrived at Notre Dame in 1916, he thought of himself as a baseball player. What happened to change that thinking?
Well, he did. He was an excellent baseball player, was already being recruited by the Chicago White Sox and the Cubs. He had never played football in college, played sandlot football, that's about all, some semi-pro football around the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. He came from the little town of Laurium near Calumet, Michigan. And one day, Newt Rockne was walking across campus, and he saw this guy booming drop kicks, no less, 50, 60 yards in the air. And Rockne, totally stunned, stopped to watch, and he saw he was kicking. This guy in street clothes was booting these amazing drop kicks to a freshman player who was in uniform, who just finished practice. And he walked over to him, and he said, "What's your name?" And he said, "George Gipp." And he said, "Are you here for football?" He said, "No, I'm a baseball player. Baseball's my game." And he said, "You interested in football?" He said, "No, not at all." And Rockne persisted. He was very persistent, to say the least. And he saw this guy looked very athletic, you know, 6 feet tall, about 180, and said, "How about coming out for football, giving it a shot?" And Gipp said, not really. Anyway, Rockne finally convinced him to come out. Gipp said he would, and then when Gipp went back to his dorm, he had no intention of going out. But somehow, the next day, he decided to give it a shot, went out for the freshman team, and within a couple of days, he was running right through the varsity.
The frequent claim that no player at Notre Dame has eclipsed George Gipp is extraordinary, given how many great players Notre Dame has produced over the last 90 years or so. But make the case for Gipp as the best who ever played for the Irish.
It's pretty well accepted at Notre Dame by historians at Notre Dame. People have been around a long time that nobody could do what he could do. And he could do it all. He could do it offensively, defensively, great runner, great passer, maybe the best passer in college football at a time when not many schools, many teams were throwing the ball because it was, you know, oblong, 3 inches wider than the ball is today, a hard ball to throw. He was a great drop kicker who once kicked a 62-yard field goal. Gipp was told to punt by the coach and the quarterback and said, "Hey, no, I go for the field goal. It's tied." And it's snow, windy day, and he drop kicks a 62-yard field goal. Beside that, he punted. He was a great punter. And Rockne always said that in 4 years of college football, a pass was never completed in George Gipp's zone. Gipp played right halfback. Today he'd be right cornerback. That's remarkable, even though they didn't throw the ball as much as they do today. Not one single pass being completed in his area. Remarkable.
Of course, we don't have the film to confirm that, I'm afraid.
Unfortunately, we don't, Bill. Unfortunately, we don't.
Even before he began playing football, Gipp had started playing pool and poker in South Bend and beyond. How good was he at those games?
He was very good. He was very good. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons why he dropped out of high school and he didn't play football in high school. He played a little basketball. He didn't play baseball either. He was too busy after school shooting pool and playing cards. And by the time he got to South Bend, he was an accomplished pool shooter, both straight pool and billiards, three-corner billiards. And so good that his last 2 years at Notre Dame, he won the South Bend Billiards Championship. I mean, I've got clips from the newspapers in South Bend where, you know, Gipp wins city billiards title again. Drove Rockne crazy. Rockne figured this guy's down shooting pool when he should be in bed. And not only that, but he shot pool for a lot of money.
All right, so George Gipp never actually graduated from high school, and during what were purportedly his sophomore and junior years at Notre Dame, Gipp received no grades, none. Did Coach Rockne notice?
He must have. He said he didn't. But you notice what's interesting, proving that this guy was really smart. In his first year, he did quite well. He mainly got B's the first year. And second and third year, he went to an occasional class but didn't take any exams. Consequently, he didn't get any grades. Somebody, some professors along the way, must have told Rockne about this. I mean, you know, the school was only about 1,500 at most students. And he must have told him about Rockne. Rockne being Rockne, feigned ignorance of Gipp not going to class too often. And they had this symbiotic relationship. You know, Rockne was the opposite of Gipp, very disciplined, organized man, you know. Great student, almost straight-A student, Notre Dame, Rockne was. And here's Gipp, you know, who was to say the least, as you said at the outset, not a very good student.
George Gipp died in 1920, shortly after his final game at Notre Dame, of what was probably a strep infection. In the film Newt Rockne All-American, Ronald Reagan played Gipp, and as he's dying, Gipp tells his coach to inspire his team on some dark day by exhorting them thusly.
Rock, someday when the team's up against it, the brakes are beating the boys, ask them to go in there with all they've got. Win just one for the Gipper.
Now, Jack, you point out that Gipp didn't call himself the Gipper, and neither did very many other people. Is that story a fable?
The genesis of all this was about 30 years ago. I wrote a story in Sports Illustrated about George Gipp. Mainly, I did it to try to find out whether indeed he told Rockne on his deathbed, that is on Gipp's deathbed, win one for the Gipper. And quite a few of his teammates were still alive. They were in their 80s, some of them were almost 90, including a couple who roomed with him. And one of them was Hunk Anderson, All-American player and coach who played with the Bears later on and coached the Bears. And Hunk told me, and some others told me, they were convinced that he did say to Rockne on his deathbed, you know, win one for the Gipper. But there are other people who doubt it. There are other teammates I talked to said, hey, this guy was much too cynical. He wasn't a sentimentalist at all. And Rockne, who was prone to stretch the truth, to say the least, as I point out in the book, some of the pep talks, a lot of the stories he told were apocryphal. You know, he made them up to inspire the players. Even the players know, hey, this is probably not true, but maybe it is true. So one question that arises, Gipp said that on his deathbed in 1920, why did he wait till the Notre Dame Army game in 1928, 8 years later, before relaying that story? And yet he waited. Well, one of the reasons, of course, was that was probably Rockne's worst team, and they were a prohibitive underdog to Army-Yankee Stadium, and, of course, they won the game.
I think my favorite apocryphal pep talk story from your book has Rockne saying the players have to win for Rockne's own son, the little boy who's at home in the hospital and very sick, and they get home on the train, and the little boy's jumping up and down on the train platform. He's never been healthier in his life.
typical of Rockne. And that's why, you know, Gipp, for one, being quite cynical, a kind of man of the world, you know, guy, went to Notre Dame at the age of 21, which was not uncommon in those days. And you know, and Gipp would kind of snicker at Rockne's pep talks. But they was kind of like white lies. You know, they weren't really malicious, colossal lies. They were just designed to inspire the players, and the players accepted it. For the most part, they loved Rock.
I'm speaking with Jack Cavanaugh, author of The Gipper, and you're listening to Only a Game. Notre Dame was ahead of its time in using football to market the university around the country. Have there been any drawbacks to that strategy for Notre Dame?
I think so. I know for the fact when I was out doing research at Notre Dame last fall, and I know some Notre Dame officials still cringe when you know, they meet people and they'd say they're from Notre Dame, professors, whatever, on the staff. And the first question they're asked, how's the football team going to do this fall? And I know a lot of students, you probably do too, and it's kind of sad. Here's one of the best academic schools in the country, and students invariably are asked when they go home, and it bothers the average student. And that carried on and on. Even back in the Gipp era, in Rockne era, the administrators getting concerned that the school was getting to be known as kind of a football factory. and not a good academic institution. Along that line, it succeeded so well academically that last year, the 2009 season, only two schools in the country, football tier one football schools, had the highest rate of graduates, 96%. The schools were Duke and Notre Dame. They were higher than any other Division I schools.
The title of the book is The Gipper. That was probably irresistible. And the expression, The Gipper, has been such an enduring phrase, I guess partly because Ronald Reagan trotted it out so often when he was in the White House.
I think I can thank Ronald Reagan immensely for continuously invoking The Gipper while he was in the White House. And also when he went out to Notre Dame in 1981 to deliver a commencement address during his first term. And sure enough, during the commencement address, he said at the end, let's win one for the Gipper, meaning him. He was constantly, when he wanted trying to get a bill through, through Congress, he would say over and over again, let's win this one for the Gipper. The 1988 convention, when George Bush the first was running for president, and at the convention, he famously turned to George Bush, and he said, George, let's win one for the Gipper. And the whole country saw it on television. Strangely enough, along that line, when I asked people at talks who were, have you heard the expression, win one for the Gipper, everybody raises their hand of all ages. Mm-hmm. Then I'll say, well, who was the Gipper? Maybe if there are 25 people, one or two hands will go up. It's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. The expression lives on, but the man himself, very little is known about him.
Jack Cavanaugh is the author of The Gipper, George Gipp, Newt Rockne, and The Dramatic Rise of Notre Dame Football. It's published by Skyhorse, and the author joined me from WSHU in Connecticut. Jack, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com/NPR. This is NPR.
Passers-by who weren't in on the promotion may have thought two Thai senators had come to blows in Bangkok on Monday, but in fact the Honorable Payap Thung Chuen and the perhaps equally Honorable Direk Thung Phang were kickboxing with each other in front of the Parliament building. But according to Mr. Thung Phang, the two legislators were merely trying to promote the sport as an attraction and to encourage young men to take up the traditional practice. Though spectators felt Direk Thung Phang, who is 64, got the best of his 59-year-old opponent, the judge proclaimed the fighters, who are both former professional boxers, joint winners, which may not have pleased everybody in the joint. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a second chance at glory for some formerly adolescent Chicago basketball players. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The New York Giants visit the Indianapolis Colts tomorrow evening. Are you ready for Manning v. Manning 2?
I am, because I think the Colts and the Giants has already become a very depressing football game. Neither team played very well last week. And, it's interesting because of the fact, of course, that Peyton has a lot more freedom to run his offense than Eli does in New York and is probably the far better quarterback.
The NFL sent a memo to each of the league's teams on Wednesday. The memo followed charges that members of the New York Jets had harassed a female TV reporter in their locker room, and it read in part, quote, "Please remember that women reporters are professionals and should be treated as such." So that ought to take care of it, right?
Well, certainly I thought it had taken care of it 25 years ago, but apparently
too.
It hasn't. Clinton Portis of the Washington Redskins went a little nutty on the radio about it and had to walk what he's saying back. Guys, it doesn't matter what the woman is wearing. You don't get to think with parts of your body that is not your brain. You don't get to speak with parts of the body that is not your brain. You're not 14-year-old guys fighting your father's Playboy under the mattress. Grow up, please.
When the Philadelphia Eagles face the Detroit Lions tomorrow, Michael Vick will get his first regular season start at quarterback since 2006. The Eagles' regular guy, Kevin Cobb, is out with a concussion after a less-than-stellar start for that team. After grooming Cobb for three seasons, you think the Eagles management is hoping for Vic to do well or maybe not so well?
Well, I think they're hoping for the Eagles to do well, and for them to do well, Michael Vick's going to have to do well. This is the position they put themselves in when they brought this guy into camp. Sooner or later, he was going to have to play because sooner or later, everybody's quarterback gets hurt. That having been said, Vic had a terrific game against the Packers. He was 16 for 24 and 175 yards, and he ran for 103, and the Eagles almost beat him in what would have been a terrific comeback.
Both Kevin Cobb and Eagles linebacker Stuart Bradley re-entered last Sunday's game, albeit briefly, after receiving concussions. Were you surprised that both the league and the players' union said the Eagles had handled those situations correctly?
Well, according to Andy Reid, the coach of the Eagles, they followed the league criteria, which leads me to believe that somebody ought to have a look at the league criteria and do his job a little bit better. Bradley is the one that's really astonishing to me. He banged his head on a teammate's leg. He got up, walked a couple of steps, and then fell right on his face. And yet they brought him back, and they did whatever the approved NFL criteria are and put him back in the game. This, to me, if a guy gets up, walks two steps, and falls down, it probably has an issue that you keep him out of the game for the rest of the day.
Charlie, for several years, running back Reggie Bush, late of the University of Southern California, has been saying that neither he nor his family accepted money or gifts when he was still in college. He's still saying that, but he's agreed to give the Heisman Trophy back anyway. What's going on?
Well, basically, I think we're all doing PR moves now. I don't know why Reggie Bush would do this. He says he talked to his pastor, and his pastor was the only one who advised him to give the trophy back. Here's my question. Mike Garrett, the athletic director at the University of Southern California, at the time Reggie Bush was not receiving benefits from anyone while playing there, is also a Heisman Trophy winner.
Yes.
Why doesn't he have to give his back?
And then there's O.J. Simpson.
Well, we're not even going to get into that. I'm comparing, you know, apples to apples in terms of offenses against NCAA regulations.
Got it.
I'm not going into, like, prison stuff.
Football players at the University of Miami were probably not delighted to be urged by their mentors not to tweet. But who can argue with the method by which the players received that urging?
Yes, the statement was released on the athletic department's Twitter feed.
Of course it was. They knew they'd be paying attention.
I've got to tell you, I have to wonder. I really do have to wonder if there isn't a free speech case here somewhere. Guy's in his apartment or in his, you know, richly appointed dorm room, you know, and wants to get in touch with, you know, whoever his personal agent is. Why shouldn't he be able to Twitter the guy? Why does he have to email?
It all comes back around to agents.
It does.
Charlie, since we last spoke, Rafael Nadal became the U.S. Open tennis champion. He's won all the majors now, and Nadal's most recent achievement has some people calling him the next Roger Federer. So, time for that coronation?
Well, he's got a career Grand Slam. He's only 24 years old. Of course, he does have rickety knees, so we don't know how much great tennis we're going to get out of him. This was sort of sad because it was his first U.S. Open championship, and because of rain delays and because of the endless way they run the U.S. Open, you know, he won this thing on a Monday night when half the country was watching Monday Night Football, and nobody really knew it, and he played extraordinarily well.
Also, since our last conversation, Kevin Durant et al. Have brought home the FIBA World Basketball Championship for the first time in 16 years. Were you impressed by their 81-64 win over Turkey in the final?
I was impressed by the way they played all the way through the tournament. This is a team that had really no big man and none of the foremost famous names in the NBA. And people like Andre Iguodala and Russell Westbrook really pushed their stock up. And I don't mean to be cynical and mercenary about this, but they're going to make a lot of money when they're free agents eventually now.
On Thursday night, the Seattle Storm became WNBA champions for the second time. Would you like to offer a tip of the cap to the Raging Storm? Sorry, I couldn't resist that.
Wow, that's very nice. Thank you, Bill. No, it was a great season. They lost six games in the regular season and won the title fairly easily.
And finally, Charlie, Tom Brady, the guy about whom you wrote a fine book, tied a record this week. He joined Joe Montana as the only football player ever to have appeared on the cover of Sports Illustrated 12 times. And you know Tom, so why didn't you tell him to get a haircut before the cover
shoot? No, this is the new look. I am unqualified, both professionally and, as you can tell, personally, to discuss matters of grooming.
Charlie Pierce's profile of New England Patriots nose tackle Vince Wilfork, called Team Wilfork, appears in Sunday's Boston Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
In response to Karen Given's story last week about a professional disc golf tournament, the disc golf community filled the Only a Game inbox, mostly with comments posted to our website. "So happy to see this," wrote Carl. "I can't wait for the day disc golf becomes more mainstream. For the time being, I'll continue explaining why I have 25 frisbees in the back of my car." And Isaac Bromberg added, "As a longtime fan of Only a Game and an aspiring disc golfer, I was delighted to hear the piece. Thanks for giving those of us who play one of the lesser-known sports a brief moment in the spotlight." Karen Given's commentary posted this week on the website also drew numerous responses. In connection with the Ines Sines New York Jets incident, Karen acknowledged that she doesn't enjoy working in locker rooms and wishes leagues like the NFL would follow the lead of organizations that make the players available while said players are wearing their clothes, whether in the locker room or elsewhere. She wrote that she hopes that doesn't make her a bad feminist, to which Sally Gore tweeted as follows: "I don't believe asking for common decency and a sense of professionalism from professional athletes makes one a bad anything." Vicki Herndon's response to Karen's commentary was similarly supportive. "Thank you," she wrote, "for your refreshingly non-politically correct reporting on this subject. Kudos for your honesty and common sense. You're a winner." A listener named Alexandra added, "Well said, Karen. It doesn't make any sense to have anyone interviewed while they are getting dressed. It's absurd for journalists of both genders and athletes alike to have to endure this silly routine." We also got an email this week from Steve Smithson, who listens to Only a Game in Meridian, Mississippi. "I don't like sports," he wrote, "and I don't dislike sports, but I do like your show. That Littlefield cat cracks me up. Laughter is the key to life." So there, Karen. If you wish to praise Karen or her work, or perhaps claim you went to high school with her, write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. More than 10 years ago, the boys' basketball team from Brother Rice High School on Chicago's South Side was looking ahead to a promising postseason. Going into the Illinois State playoffs, they had nearly twice as many wins as their opponents from nearby Bloom Township High, but fate and a disputed call intervened, and Bloom's Blazing Trojans eked out a two-point victory, sending the Warriors into a prolonged funk. Life and sports don't usually offer second chances, but reality television? That's a different story. 10 years after the controversial game, Chicago Public Radio's Alex Keefe caught up with the players from both teams as they prepared to play the biggest game of their lives all over again.
It's practice night, a recent Thursday at a gym on Chicago's South Side. And the players, all of whom graduated from Brother Rice High at least 10 years ago, are now racing against the clock to regain their youth.
The body just really doesn't respond like that anymore.
Vince Green was a star point guard back in 2000. He now works as a mental health counselor, but recently he's been training to play ball like a teenager again, which isn't so easy.
You're sore, and you got to go to work, and then you got to come here. You made a commitment. It's just like it took you back to high school and college.
Rotate down. Johnny, stop. Don't face the ball. You got to face the front of the court where you can see everything.
Pat Richardson has been coaching Brother Rice basketball for 22 years. He was on the sidelines a decade ago when his Crusaders were a shoo-in for the state quarterfinals, only to be upset by Bloom Township. Now he relishes the opportunity to undo the loss he never quite let go.
You've worked out for 8 weeks for one game. We want to win. Our fans want us to win. But, you know, it doesn't get back what happened 10 years ago.
But the folks at the reality show called Gatorade Replay, now airing on the Fox Sports Network, are hoping otherwise. The shtick is simple. Find old games that ended contentiously, get the original players back into fighting shape, and then give them a second crack at the matchup. All, of course, under the watchful eye of the reality TV lens. But peel away the cameras and the corporate logos, and underneath, the sense of competition and injustice is as fresh as ever. Brother Rice forward Sidney Holmes has played hundreds of games since that night, both in the CBA and in the Portuguese Pro League, but still.
That was the worst loss ever, because we just knew we were going to win that game. It was the worst feeling of my career in basketball.
I'm here at the East Aurora Super Sectional. After tonight's game, only one team will be left.
March 4th, 2000. The gymnasium is packed with screaming fans.
Obviously, we was the underdogs. We wasn't supposed to be in the game, so they was a big favorite.
Joe Chapman was a guard for the Bloom Township Blazing Trojans, one of the team's best players.
So we went in there and we tried to stall the ball, you know, just take the air out of the ball and give it our best.
You know, they've got the two-point lead. They've got the ball. They're in no hurry here.
It was like this for the whole game. Good defense, low scoring, neither team ever gaining more than a few points on the other. Here's Bloom coach Gary Meyer.
We thought 10 years ago that if we could limit the possessions, that we would have a chance to win the game. And that chance came with, you know, 4 seconds to go.
4,000 people in the East Aurora gym. About 3,000 of them on their feet right now.
It was Bloom's ball, and the score was tied at 40. Now, to understand why 28 grown men with wives and careers would go through so much trouble to settle a score from a decade ago, we need to focus on those 4.6 seconds.
Here we go.
Bloom passes the ball into one of its best players, Philip Alexander, who takes his shot.
Alexander, turn around!
Took a shot, went off the rim, fell into Chapman's hands.
I was obviously right in a position to hurry up and tip the ball in, so.
Went up on the rim and then bounced.
Yes! Did it go?
They counted it!
Count the basket! Bloom is your Super Sectional champion!
A sea of fans in blazing Trojan blue floods the court, but the game's not quite over. One of the scorers, Mike Minervini, says the official timekeeper that night was so worried that the crowd would drown out the buzzer, he brought a starter pistol to sound the end of the game.
And about half a second to a second later, shot it. The officials heard the gun. They didn't hear the buzzer.
And so, Brother Rice argued, Joe Chapman's alleged buzzer beater did beat the gun, but didn't beat the buzzer.
Pat Richardson doesn't buy it. He doesn't think that shot got off in time.
And nobody could ever convince me otherwise, because I've seen the tape probably more than anybody in the world. It's clearly not good.
Richardson was furious. He screamed at the officials. He even refused to take his team off the court. But in the end, the ruling was that Joe Chapman's tip was good, and Bloom won the game 42-40.
Today we're going to go 5-on-0, everything.
Back on the practice court, Richardson paces among Brother Rice players as they stretch. He briefs them on the schedule for tomorrow night's game, tells them what to wear for the TV cameras, but those 4.6 seconds aren't far from his mind.
Tomorrow night, they will use instant replay. 10 years too late, but they will use instant replay.
On the night of the rematch, fans of both sides file into a neutral gym hours before tip-off. Many of the same fans who were at the game a decade ago.
It's going to be a tip-in. At the buzzer. Another repeat. A replay, a repeat.
25-8, win the series win. 25-8, win the series win.
After some pep from the original cheer squads brought back for one night only, the crowd settles in for tip-off. Brother Rice sinks three-pointers from the get-go. By the half, both teams have already scored more points than they did during the whole game 10 years ago. The Bloom Blazing Trojans head into the locker room at halftime, trailing by 10 points, which hasn't escaped the notice of Bloom assistant coach Pete McGuire.
If the game's in your hands, now you've been bugging to do it. Now the game's in your hands. Kick their ass. But get to the rim, Snuff.
In the second half, the old intensity comes rushing back. Players sprinting up and down the court, yelling at the refs, and then, with about 5 minutes left in the third, Bloom sticks a monster layup to take the lead. For a while, it's back and forth, but Brother Rice inches forward, and with less than a minute left, Vince Green hits a pair of free throws that seal the deal. It's 99-93, the clock runs out, and Brother Rice's 10-year overtime finally comes to an end.
We got this.
It's a wrap, baby.
This time around, it's a crowd of Brother Rice orange that's rushing the court. The players sign autographs. They talk about revenge, redemption, vindication. But Joe Chapman, the Bloom player whose controversial tip kindled the rematch, has some other ideas.
obviously they got their revenge today, so it's 1-1. We need to have a rubber match, and we're looking forward to the next game.
For Only a Game, I'm Alex Keefe in Chicago.
To view photos of the players who represented Brother Rice and Bloom Township High Schools then and now, please visit our website. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Jack Flagler is our intern. We had help this week from Stu Kennedy at WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archive chosen stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from L.A. Times college football reporter T.J. Simers, who has this money-saving tip for the Heisman Trust, which now has a spare Heisman trophy on its hands, courtesy of Reggie Bush.
The trophy that they have now, I suspect they'll just rip the name tag off and give it to the next kid who comes along this year to save some money.
Yeah, it would probably be worth more as a memorabilia if Reggie Bush's name was still on it. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.